Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4.
They steal the door where they started the chain.
Okay, I'm on the northbound access.
I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jinx Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome, everybody. I'm here with my good friend Aaron in the deep, dark confines of Studio 4. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, you know, this is probably our last podcast of 2015, our virgin or our maiden year of our podcast of many years to follow. We hope, maybe, we don't know.
Is it it's a sophomore year? It's a freshman year?
It's our freshman year.
Freshman year. It's the first season.
First season. Yeah, the first season. Ah, that's it. In the showbiz language, this is our first season. Aaron's got some cameras running, and we will put this show up as a live show on YouTube, I guess, and I'll probably embed it on my website.
You could watch it live right now at BigDumbFunShow.com.
Oh, could you? Well, go to
BigDumbFunShow.com. If you, but you wouldn't even know unless you just happened to go there.
Yeah, nobody.
Or you went and did like a tweet all of a sudden and said, "Hey, by the way, this is live.
This is live. Maybe someday we'll do this live and record it and put it up also for the convenience of the people that want to watch it live. And I think most people want to watch it at their own convenience. The way I or listen to it, the way I listen to my podcast is as I go to sleep at night. I set that 30-minute timer on it, and usually I'm about asleep, and I may wake back up. If I have any trouble going back to sleep, I'll
put in another episode.
Put another episode on and start listening to that, and I'll go to sleep on that, and then it'll shut off. And then the next night, I'll go back and see where I left off, and I'll slide the bar back a little bit. And
now, are you talking about your own podcast?
Well, I've listened to my own podcast.
That probably puts you to sleep right away.
No.
I've heard this before.
That one keeps me up half the night. But I
picking out all the little, like, why is I can hear that humming again.
Aaron, can you really?
No, I can't. Oh, I'm okay. Just saying, if I was you, I would.
I'm in love with the sound of my own voice, as they say. Has anybody ever said that about you? You must be in love with the sound of your own voice. Anyhow, so we had one show scheduled or planned tonight, and that didn't come out because we were going to come through because we were going to have a guest, but we have a backup plan because I did want to get one more in before the end of the year. And what this is kind of a teaser about I'm a big part of next year. I've got two, and I'm going to put out one more Freedom of Information Act request, and one of them's been out there for several months, and the next one I just put out because the guy just died. The subject that I'm inquiring about has to be deceased. So, and who these people are, the third one is a guy named Jerry Stevens, and I know he's dead. I got to figure out how to get some kind of proof that he's dead. The other two, Tiger Cartarello, it was easy to find newspaper clippings that he had been killed. He was a victim of a mob hit. And James Harvey Jr. Bradley died a natural death just recently, so I had his obit, and I attached that to my...
Your Facebook.
My Facebook. I think I did. Did I put that on Facebook? Did I Facebook that?
Was that the one that you Facebook posted and people commented back on?
I think so, but I can't remember. I had a running commentary with somebody that knew him and wanted to know that if I knew him
personally,
and I didn't really know him personally, but I felt like I did.
And we're not talking about Tiger.
No, we're not talking about that. It's James Harvey Jr. Jr. Bradley. We're going to talk a lot about Jr. Bradley, but the reason these three subjects are going to be subjects of the Gangland Wire Crime Stories next year is these three men were what in the mob parlance are called earners. They could earn money, and they could earn a lot of money because they had action going, and they were all three had the similar kind of action going, and it was primarily dealing with professional shoplifters and dealing with people who may steal a truckload of aspirin or a truckload of jeans or a truckload of records, long play albums. You can't really, you got to hijack.
No one's stealing albums
you
anymore.
You can't steal an album
well,
anymore.
CDs.
You go in and hack in and pirate an album and then sell it. I'm sure it's still going on.
I mean, the people pirate
the
stuff.
The Russians and the Chinese are doing it now.
In advance, I think digitally, you know, you can do that. But, you know, I think the term, the expression used as I understand it was booster.
Booster, yes.
The booster was the
professional boosters.
Yeah, professional boosters are the folks that go out and they would pick up a list, check it twice.
They knew what they were
and after. Then yeah, and they would go into a department store or a
And they were specialties. Now, some people...
I mean, they weren't lifting couches.
No, they weren't lifting couches. Some people would just go in and grab a whole rack of leather coats. that were close to the door, say down at Halls, down in the plaza, they would have a whole rack of leather coats, and the high end stores didn't really like to tie those things down. Now the lower end stores pretty quickly started running the chain through things like leather coats, but the high end stores didn't like to do that, and boosters would get those spotted, and they didn't just work Kansas City, they worked throughout the Midwest and primarily Midwest, you know. Dallas, Fort Worth area, and Oklahoma City, and Tulsa, and maybe Salina, and Wichita, and Chicago, and Omaha, and
go to Omaha. They'd go to Salina,
right? Well, I mean, they go to the shopping centers.
Yeah, in these other places,
these
not
other
just
cities,
in Kansas
just
City.
They just go on boosting trips.
Yeah, they wouldn't be there, and then they would find somebody they would sell the boosted items to.
No, they bring them all back because they had.
They had a list and they were checking it twice.
Right, exactly. They knew what they were after, and Tiger wanted record albums. Junior Bradley, he wanted anything that was small. He would take anything basically that he could turn and make a buck on. But what he really liked in his retail outlet was for small items that were high dollar that you might steal out of a grocery store, pharmaceutical area, or a pharmacy, drugstore. You know, for
like
example,
personal items,
perfume and perfume too is big in perfume. And so perfume and, aspirin and razor blades and toothpaste, those are all pretty high dollar items. They're real small. So you get a booster coat and you'd go in and usually worked in pairs and a booster coat is, it would have a long coat of some kind. And we're talking back in the 70s, a lot of leather coats were out there and long leather coats. And they would just sew a really long pocket on the each side. And they just go in and get one person to watch out for them. And it was kind of, it's what they called the block and tackle method. You had a blocker and a tackler. There'd be two of you. And one person had the booster coat on and they would just go up the display and just start filling up the pockets. And then if they thought, store security or a clerk was getting suspicious as they started walking out, if anybody would make a move to try to stop the person with the stolen items, then the blocker or the tackler would then take out that person in some manner, you know, whether it would be hard or whether it would be easy.
Just to distract them or
distract them, or they may just run right into them and knock them down. Kind of would depend on each circumstance was different, but they wanted to let that person with the evidence get away because once you were gone with the evidence, there's no crime.
Well, wait a second.
It's shrinkage. You know, there's not really a
Are we talking about in the 70s? When you were a police officer,
sure,
this is the kind of stuff that was going on.
And I'm sure it still goes on.
It still goes on, but I'm just saying that, I mean, video cameras weren't as prevalent.
No video cameras. Yeah, there were no video cameras.
Video cameras at that time weren't as prevalent as they are now, which it would seem like it would be really hard to, I mean, I guess you could go into, you know, a drugstore and, you know, surveil it by walking around and kind of identify. But a lot of those, you know, locations, they put the surveillance camera in a black dome so you can't even tell where it's looking.
Right.
You just know where it's at.
Of course, then they have to match you up with the person that took it out. And then it's still a hard case to make because...
And you have to get them with the goods.
You need to get them with the goods past the cash register, basically. Now, if you have a professional booster and you have an aggressive prosecutor who really wants to put a lot of energy into this and take a chance on a jury trial, I mean, I'd go to a jury trial in a second if all you had was me standing at a rack and concealing something and then walking away, unless you had continuous camera coverage of me that would show I had not laid it back down somewhere else or I had not handed it to somebody else who paid for it or... I mean, you really paid for it. Come back in a store.
If you can identify them on video,
right?
And you see them what appears to be them putting stuff into their coat, mm-hmm. walking out of the store without paying it. If you don't capture them in that moment,
they're pretty much gone.
They're pretty much gone. I mean, you might know who they are because you learned to kind of their pattern, so you're identifying who they are, and shake them down, if you will. In the stop, you know, try to sweat them out.
Yeah, you go stop them. I mean, they're never going to.
But if they're any good, they're just going to be like, they know.
They're just going to blow you off. Yeah, they're just going to say, you know, call my lawyer.
Yeah.
Or just dummy up and just not say anything or change the subject. I mean, you know, these are professional criminals here. These are not people that you can really.
Yeah, this isn't somebody with like a regular 9-to-5 job who then on the nights and the weekends.
This isn't a 14-year-old kid that got caught shoplifting for the second or third time or even for the first time. These are hard people. And
do you think that's how it started for them, though? They were just like kids going, hey, I really want some candy. I got no money.
Exactly.
And then it kind of blossomed into a business.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's how it starts. Starts for everybody that way. And they see how easy it is. I mean, go into any store and look how easy it would be just to put something in your pocket and walk out.
Now there's a lot of video cameras.
Even if so.
And a lot of places, grocery stores, they have an off-duty officer.
Yeah, I did.
Right at the front of the store.
Well, then he's got to be alerted.
Someone has to say something.
Video camera and say that I saw him take this item from the shelf. And then they got to watch you continuously and then catch you go past. They got to wait till you get past the cash register and then stop you and then find that item on you. Then you got it. And
then you got him.
And then if they go to trial, then you got to have all those people come in and testify.
What kind of time could somebody get for stealing small personal items, even if you had $100 worth?
The first time around, nothing. You'll easily get a deferred diversion.
Yeah, they'll send you the treatment.
Diversion. There's a shoplifting school. A friend of mine came up with a shoplifting school that he sold to all the court systems throughout the United States. It was a series of classes that they were sentenced to attend, and it explained about the problem of shoplifting and the reasons why people shoplift, and trying to see where some of these people may be kleptomaniacs, and so maybe there would be a little bit of a therapeutic aspect to it.
So did he talk about boosters and supplying personal items for resale by other people?
Right, not none of this.
Not so much about that.
That's a whole different ballgame. You know.
He's just thinking these are like first-time offenders, kids. And girls that wanted a pair of jeans.
Correct. That's
tell them about the consequences of their actions in the long term.
The shoplifting school was good for them. It made no difference. But professional boosters, and they'll try to jump around different jurisdictions. You won't know. Maybe they got popped in Kansas City twice with a city court case, and the mm-hmm. third time you go to state court and it's a felony. But they get popped once in Kansas City. They get popped one in KCK. They get popped once in
Omaha,
Topeka or Omaha, something. And once in St. Louis. And if it's a smaller items, then it used to be $100. Now I think it has to be $500 or something to be charged in state court with a felony, but I'm not sure.
As a felony, but otherwise it's a misdemeanor.
Correct. And usually it's a city charge, which is even less than a misdemeanor. That's
well,
what we call
kind of
offense.
Culling off all of the people that may be kleptomaniacs and just want it for whatever reason. The people that aren't your career professional criminals, the boosters. How many does it take to keep a guy, in business, if he's got a shop? I mean, how many boosters do you think can work the region?
I'm trying to remember how many boosters that I knew of, professional boosters. I knew of just one little clique of professional boosters, and there was two man and woman couples. There was four of them, and they were in kind of the same clique. They hung out together. They had a couple other men that would maybe boost with them once in a while. And so that's just one little click. And of course, they were stealing primarily high-end items. They were stealing fur coats at something like Alaskan Fur. They were going to museums and cutting out paintings. They were going to someplace like Halls and stealing the Lalique crystal. So they weren't
wasting time.
No, no.
On low-dollar items.
Anytime they got caught, it was a felony. Matter of fact, that's how we tracked them down into Tulsa, Oklahoma once. We got their trash. We knew where they were living, and we got their trash, and we found a note in there. And the note, her name was Dorothy, and his name was Frank. Frank Clayton and Dorothy Ganey. There was a note in there for some reason, and she ended it with something about, thank God we got out of that horrible state of Oklahoma. And we thought, and it was real recent. You know, this was, you know, over the last couple of weeks, you know, it was like a week's worth of trash. And over the last couple of weeks, we went down to the main cities in Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And I can't remember, there might've been a couple others, but I know we went to those, to the local police departments and said, you know, was there anything significant? And we're looking at these people as high end boosters.
Yeah.
Was there anything significant that happened? And I think it was Tulsa. They came back and they said, you know, we had a lady start to walk out with a fur coat of one of our fur shops after she was trying it on. And as she got to the door, the clerk went to intercept her. And then some man stepped in between and pushed the clerk back. And then they both left with the coat.
They left with the coat.
Right. And we said, uh-huh. So we sent pictures of Dorothy Ganey and Frank Clayton down. They said, bam, that's them.
That's them.
That's them. Now.
The police, they actually probably had to go take the photos to the retail location, show them to the clerk who reported the incident.
Now, they saw the coat. They saw him walk out with a coat, so they knew the coat was gone. So they didn't really have to have the coat as evidence. It's not a little bit different.
Well, they had a witness.
They had a good witness that saw him put the coat on and saw him walk out. And so they actually charged Dorothy Ganey with theft of that for a coat down in Tulsa. I don't remember. We got
even though they
other things.
Even remember. Though they didn't actually find her in her possession.
And I don't know that they got a guilty plea. She probably pled out on the case. You know, got.
Well, did they have to take her back to Oklahoma to run the case?
Yeah, they would have. Yes. You know, I didn't really follow up on it. They made their case. The last I heard, they had a warrant for. This has been a long time ago, and we were off into a couple other people and we had them shoplifting in other cities and then selling to some high-end people. One guy that owned a real well-known delicatessen, one guy who was an executive for a truck line, another guy was a well-known urologist, a doctor. And so we got into that and we kind of, I don't even know what happened to Frank Clayton and Dorothy Ganey after that, because we got on. And when I tell this story, well, I'll have all the details on that. But I watched this one booster, Marvin Gabb. We were following him and we knew that they had been stealing paintings out of town. We knew they had stolen a famous painting out of a Remington, out of an Omaha museum. Anytime they get back in town, we had a surveillance on their home base. And so we were following him and we followed him, and he met with this doctor who was a well-known, respected urologist, lived over in Johnson County. But we didn't know who he was. We just knew he met this guy in the back of the parking lot at Cosentino's down in Brookside. And we saw it was a large square item and handed it to this guy. And
like a box.
It was like a painting.
Oh.
It was a painting size, and it wasn't a box.
It was thin.
It was
rectangular.
Rectangular. It was wrapped. I don't know what was inside of it. So he handed.
But you watched him do this.
He watched him do this, and he hands it to this guy, and this guy gets out and gets in his car. And so we take that guy, because we got a tag number on him, but we don't know who he is. But you want to make sure, you know, he looks legitimate. Looks like you find the tag number, you're going to figure out who he is. So we follow him. We follow him to this real nice house out in Johnson County and put him inside. We see him go inside the house, and somebody, you know, there's about a 10-man surveillance on this guy. And so, you know, then we go on. Well, eventually. I mean, that's just part of this big ongoing
investigation. Did he take whatever it was out of his car and take it into the house?
Yeah, to best of my memory, I believe he did.
But that wasn't sufficient evidence with the police witnessing it.
For all we knew, it was just a pile of bunch of papers.
Yeah, movie poster.
Right, movie poster. We didn't. We had no idea what it was. But when we finally catch this shoplifter dirty on something else, the name is Marvin Gabb. And he wanted to snitch his way out of this, and so he had to give up these people who had been buying these art objects from him and his little crew. And so he said, yeah, They ask him about meeting this doctor, and I won't say his name because I think he's still alive. And did he get convicted? We had a trial. I'll have to check on that because this will be part of a
longer episode, actually, longer specific episode, more because
story
you
because I've got to do
your Freedom of Information
Act stuff back before I'm going to go into it. But yeah, we had a doctor then. Marvin Gabb says he stole his painting from, say, the Topeka Museum of Natural History. And he stole his painting from there and he sold it to the doctor. And yes, that day that we were following him, that's what he handed the doctor because he was now becoming a state's witness.
Yeah. To save his own skin.
To save his own skin. And so then based on that, we get a search warrant. We go to the doctor's house and I'll never forget this. This is a funny little story. I'll never forget this as long as I live on the air. And we were all, there was a whole big crew of us and I was doing something else, but I heard the sergeant, Jim Kopp, say over the air, there's nobody at Dr. So-and-so's home. Would you call his office? And so whoever was manning the dispatch, we had our own private little dispatchers, a little private off the books, kind of a radio system that just the undercover guys had. And so pretty soon the gal at the dispatch calls back and says, well, he's just getting ready to go into surgery. And so Jim Kopp says, well, he said, you might tell him that we're going to have to go ahead and kick his door down then. And so then pretty soon, a few minutes later, the dispatcher comes back and says, he said that the surgery will be postponed. He'll be right there. So he came back and opened the front door and they went in and got the painting and charged him with receiving stolen property.
Well, probably a better thing than going through with the surgery, knowing the really, cops were like going to break your door too, down. I mean, yeah,
he works on your
might be a little shaky.
Anyhow, that's just a funny little story. But, you know, that's what this is a little teaser about what we're going to be coming up. We're telling about the mob and their connection to these guys who could really earn a lot of money. And the way they earned a lot of money was to be outlets for professional shoplifters and other professional criminals. Like Junior Bradley, what he had the Pumpernick Deli. Some of you listeners may have gone down there at 11th and Walnut. Right across from City Hall, a block from the police department. And Junior was a real likable guy. Everybody liked Junior. He had the Country Club Market out about 55th and Truce back in the 60s. And he was well known in the neighborhood. And everybody, people knew that Junior had the best prices on all kinds of little items, and about he could get hold of about anything and have a heck of a price on it. It was kind of like your neighborhood fence.
Even though he's like right across from City Hall.
Yeah, everybody knew it.
Everyone at City Hall, they're working there. They're like, hey, right, I really need some shaving cream.
Right. Well, I got a story for you on that. He also, down at the City Market, he had a regular retail outlet. He had a storefront down right in the middle of the City Market, which was just filled with perfume and perfume and aspirin and toothpaste and razor blades and all kinds of small high dollar items that these shoplifters were stealing. And then actually Junior in the end, he got a drug connection and all these boosters are drug addicts. And so he was trading out drugs. He had another guy handling the drugs and they were mainly Demerol and
like pills, prescription
pills. Mainly
stuff.
Pharmaceuticals.
And they'd be boosting pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, somebody else was boosting the pharmaceuticals, and they were buying them from them at a cheap price. And then they would maybe give them some money and give them some
pills.
Pills. And so it's part of this underground economy. And so Junior, he had this storefront going down there at the City Market also, and he had a rack of all those things inside of his restaurant right there by City Hall. A lot of policemen off duty there, on duty, would eat in there. I ate in there many times, and you see this little rack of aspirin and deodorant and all kinds of different little things. And Bill Owsley said, I asked Junior once, I said, what are you doing selling that stuff out of here? He said, I just get a deal on these things and I'll sell about anything. So of course, he knew, Bill knew and a lot of us knew.
But, well, Junior Bradley died here just like not even a month ago.
About a month ago he died. He'd got out of prison, spent about last 20 years, 20 to 25 years of his life in the penitentiary, and he just got out, and he was at the Columbus Park Plaza assisted living home down there. and spent his last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years down
there. Living there in Columbus Park and running the same rackets, only at the senior living facility.
Little Italy. Junior was half Italian. He was part of the, I would say he was probably who he was under exactly. I would say if anybody was an overseer to him and was his connection directly in the mob, it was also probably Willie Camisano, just like Tiger Carterella was Willie Camisano's guy. Now, Willie had...
Because these guys couldn't just do this...
What?
Of their own. These guys, you know, Junior Bradley...
He couldn't do this.
...and Tiger, they couldn't just go out and be doing this stuff.
No.
And taking all the money.
Guys, right. They were connected guys. He was half Italian. Junior Bradley was half Italian, and he was a connected guy, and he, you know, back in the 50s and 60s when he was a young thief, like he got involved with a whole bunch of postage stamps deal that some mob guys had stolen in another city, and then he was selling out through his store out there at the Country Club Market, and he took a fall for that, and he kept his mouth shut, and so he was a connected guy, and so this place down at the City Market, and the reason I say is Willie Camisano was probably his kind of the guy that oversaw him, a made guy who oversaw the action and made sure that Junior was protected and the Junior needed anything. If any of these shoplifters had ever threatened him or had ever reneged on a deal on him or ever cheated him anyway, they would have had to answer to Willie, would have taken care of that for Junior.
Junior
was not the guy who would do something himself.
He wasn't the strong arm.
He could connect it. He could get it connected up.
But people knew that.
And everybody knew that Junior was connected, even though he was a nice guy. But he, you're talking about being right there by City Hall. Here's a funny little story. I'm the sergeant over the, after I got promoted out of the intelligence unit in 1984. And I, about 87 or 88, I'm the sergeant over the shoplifting squad. We have about 4 guys that work shoplifts. Now, they don't work the organized professional shoplifting rings. They only work shoplifts if somebody gets caught. There's like detectives that just kind of handle the paperwork.
When people call from a department store or wherever, right, where they're right. Like, hey, we caught this guy.
Because resources or the time we had to just work with, you know, I had like 2 people that worked embezzlements out of stores, and I had 2 people that worked just shoplifts and those kinds of things. So one of my shoplift detectives, a nice young guy, ended up retiring a colonel, but he was not your policeman's policeman when it came to, he was more a community minded policeman. He was more of a guy who, people liked, and he was a bright guy, and you know, he could go write a report and he could interview somebody, but there was very few of us really worked the professional criminals and worked that end of police work, and there's room for all kinds of people, and so I won't name his last name. His first name was Vince, and so Vince comes back from lunch one day, and I got this guy working for me, Bill Cosgrove, one of the best policemen I ever worked with, and he was the kind of guy that could work the big boys, and he had made a career out of working gypsy scams. We had a family of gypsies in Kansas City, and he was our local expert on gypsies and gypsy scams, and Cosgrove was hip, and he knew what was up, and Vince came back from lunch one day, and he said, Bill and I standing there, and he said, man, he said, there's this place down at the City Market. You can get aspirin or razor blades and deodorant and toothpaste and all kinds of stuff like that for, gosh, about half price what you would ever have to pay for it in the
in the market.
You know, at CVS or Katz or, you know, whatever era it was. I think it was probably CVS was around by then. And even cheaper than Costco. And Bill and I looked at each other, and Bill said, Vince, where is this store? And so he describes Junior Bradley's store and where it is. And he said, we're looking at each other laughing. And Bill says, Vince, do you realize where all that stuff came from? He said, oh, I don't know where it came from. We said, you know, Vince, don't go back there anymore. All that stuff shoplifted. You don't need to be buying anything down there. I don't care how cheap it is.
Well, when you described where it was at, and everything, did you laugh because you knew it was Junior Bradley's
spot. I knew exactly what it was. I'm fresh out of the intelligence unit. I knew exactly where it was.
And so instead of saying, hey, you know, pick something up for me.
Yeah, I know. I did buy a record or two from Tiger, although I kind of did that just because, I mean, I knew they were all shoplifted, but I primarily did it because I knew, you know.
You couldn't go into the record store and just walk around and not
walk around. I wanted to go and look around, see who was in there, and I wanted a B.B. King double album, you know, and it was only like $4 and something, whereas normally about $8. So, anyhow, that's, you know, the other one was Jerry Stevens. I don't know a lot about Jerry Stevens. He had a little retail outlet over here on 43rd Street, which Westport Road west of State Line in Kansas turns into 43rd Street. And he got in all kinds of clothes over there. And you know, I'll have to depend on my Freedom of Information Act information to, I don't really know that much off the top of my head. I worked Junior. I worked him big time in a big investigation on Junior. Tell you one funny little story about that. Now my wind on down here on Junior is, this was early in the days of the, what we call freedom phones or cordless phones. And there was very few of them out there. They're pretty expensive. If you remember, they only had, first they only had one channel, then they had two channels. You could go to one channel to a second channel. And, if you had any kind of a decent police scanner, you could set the parameters of the listening just right. And you could pick up anybody on
their cordless phone.
The cordless phone, exactly. You probably had one, Aaron. And
I remember hearing about this.
And a lot of people were doing. A lot of people were just listening to their neighbors because they just go by what we called a Bearcat. Bearcat was just a trade name Bearcat scanner, and for, you know, $40 or $50, set it to those frequencies that the cell phone's on, and cut out those other frequencies so you wouldn't be disturbed by the police calls and everything coming in. And every time they picked up the phone and started talking, you'd hear exactly what they were saying.
But you had to be in somewhat close proximity.
You had to be within, especially almost line of sight. You could be, 50 yards away if you were in line of sight. But if anything became between you, then, you
like
know,
a building or trees, building or trees or glass anything. Wasn't so bad.
Right. And so Junior, he had that restaurant downtown. It was, you know, almost sidewalk to ceiling windows all around. And
what was the address of that restaurant?
It was on the corner of there's nothing there anymore. It's on the corner of 11th and Walnut.
And that's not in your app?
No, I didn't put it in the app. I might have already put it in, except I didn't even have a picture of the old store. I don't know if I can
find
one. Maybe in.
You got a picture of Junior, don't you? A mugshot.
Yeah, I got a
at
picture
least.
Of Junior. Maybe when I do this Freedom of Information Act, I'll get some pictures, and maybe we'll even have a picture, because there's a lot of pictures taken of that store. We did a huge big long surveillance on it. But anyhow, I digress. I was telling the story, a funny little story about how we first started getting on to Junior. We blew this up into a pretty big investigation and he ended up falling on and doing these last 20 years in the federal penitentiary. We got a guy out of jail, Big John Long. He was a professional booster, and we basically worked a deal with the jail and the court that he was technically still in jail, but he was in our custody. And we put him with a undercover highway patrolman we brought in from across the state. So he didn't know anybody in Kansas City, never been to Kansas City before, didn't grow up here, never worked here. And he went undercover, and they would just go out each day. And they would just go buy stuff and then take it in and sell it to Junior and Junior would just assume it was boosted.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we just take a hit on the, you know,
75%
reduction of the cost. We'd get stuff that we'd get a wholesale price on it, but still we'd have to take a hit on it. But so, and so one day they,
no, but this is an entrapment.
No, I mean, this was the
transactions
working.
Really is between Junior and the name of the guy from the, that you're sprung.
John Long, Big John. Well, Big I John. Called him Big John, and he was a big dude. See, he had credibility. Well, we needed the highway trooper to have credibility with Junior. All this was a credibility building exercise.
Yeah.
Pretending like they were professional boosters and they were thieves and they had connections. And
Big John Long kind of vouched for the undercover highway patrolman, knowing that he was a highway patrolman,
right,
though.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he was just checked out of jail, because what we did, we got a house. And so one of my, I never went out on the undercover stuff. My job was to go over there and relieve whoever is on evening shift and just sleep overnight there in the same house as Big John, so he couldn't leave and go anywhere. We're supposed to stay up all night. It was kind of hard to do, but you gotta.
Yeah, still had to keep him under custody.
He
really,
still had to be in custody. That was the deal. Is he had to be watched 24 hours a day.
But you knew you couldn't just bring some random person in.
No, no, Junior wasn't gonna deal with this.
And go, hey, Junior, I really like to tell you some of the yeah. stuff I pulled off a shelf.
He'd laugh at. He'd buy it, but didn't laugh at you.
Yeah, and you wouldn't be able to make a case.
Right, and so we weren't really trying to make a case here. We just tried to build some credibility and work our way in. And so they had an idea, and it was a genius idea because it led to a real wiretap. Let's give Junior one of these Freedom phones just as a present and see what happens. And so it's a, you know, they take the Freedom phone in and say, hey, Junior, you know, got this. You can just have this. I don't know. I don't even know how the son of a bitch works. You know, they say you can just plug it into your regular phone line. And so Junior plugs it in and figures out how it works. And he starts using the Freedom phone
from his restaurant.
And so the bus station at the time at 10th and Main, went 10th to 11th on McGee Street, was right across the street. And you had from the, it was about the fourth or fifth floor, there's some old offices, and the old city courts were up, offices or courtrooms are actually above the Continental Trailways bus station. Those of you guys who remember the Continental Trailways bus line. So we just got access to one of those offices that was about the fourth or fifth floor, but had a direct line of sight right down into Junior's restaurant with a scanner, and you could pick up everything he said.
And you don't need a court order.
And so then we start, and they had a pin register on his phone. By that time, you didn't need very much to get a order for a pin register, which will record all the numbers. So then we start picking up some dirty conversation. And we picked up things like I was telling you, Aaron, how he was so helpful to people at the assisted living when he mm-hmm. got out of the penitentiary. He had a friend of mine get hold of me and say, you hear Junior died? And I said, yeah. And he said, boy, he said he was really helpful to my dad when he moved into the assisted living down there. It was really nice to him. And that was Junior's personality. He was a nice guy. And so there's a guy that knew Junior from back in the old days. This was not a criminal associate. This was just somebody, probably a businessman or a neighbor that knew him clear back in the old Country Club Market. We had this corner store at 55th and Troost back in the 1950s and 60s, and called him up, and he said, told Junior, he said, my son is going to prison up in Leavenworth. He's, I don't remember, he had some kind of, probably some kind of a federal drug case. He wasn't some kind of a kingpin or I don't know what the crime was, but it wasn't a big time crime. He wasn't a connected deal. It was not a connected kind of a mafia thing. This was just a guy who knew Junior and knew Junior was connected. And so he called Junior up and he said, you know, my son's got to go up to the penitentiary up there in Leavenworth and do a 2 or 3 year bit. And can you help him out? Can you make sure that he doesn't get hurt and get somebody to be up there to help him out? And Junior says, well, sure, I'll do that. And then Junior starts getting on the phone, calling other people and send somebody up the penitentiary. And so this kid, when he got there, he had somebody that's going to kind of act as his protector.
Yeah, watch over him.
Watch over him and kind of show him the ropes and help him get through his bit up there at Leavenworth. So, you know, he was that kind of guy.
Well, and this was after he'd already served his 20-year stretch for...
No, this was before. But he had been up there before. He'd been up there a couple times.
Okay.
No, but he'd already been... before he went back.
But you're sitting across the street up on the fourth floor listening on the police scanner
yeah.
to the conversations he's having with people, calling in for everything and anything because now it's just like the business line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He uses it for everything, but he has a lot of dirty conversations on it. And you know, like there was this one guy, and we couldn't figure it out. We knew that the guy was bringing in Polaroid film. Now, this was back when Polaroid film was big, and it was expensive. But mm-hmm. a lot of people used Polaroid film. That was the thing. He had that store down there at the City Market stocked with Polaroid film. So we finally, doing this surveillance, we knew he was having a conversation with some guy, and this guy was showing up, and he was setting out these cases that had something about Polaroid on them, and then they'd end up down at the City Market. He stored at the City Market. So we figured out who that guy was.
Who the booster was.
Who was bringing the Polaroid film. We figured, we heard the phone calls. We knew that he was bringing this Polaroid film. We knew that Junior was buying it and put it down the market, but we couldn't figure out what the deal was because he wasn't a shoplifter. He just seemed like a square John guy. And so when it all came down and we did a big bust and we confiscated everything out of Junior's stores and arrested him and arrested a couple of three boosters. It was much more complicated than that. I'll have to
like you almost had to wait till the boosters were there with him.
Well, it worked it well. It worked into a drug thing, and then we arrested people. Then we're going to end up testifying against Junior, and John Long was supposed to testify. I don't think he ever did, but I don't think we needed him. We had the highway patrolman that.
Did you put John back in the slammer then when you were done with him?
No.
Did he get a break on his case or his time?
Yeah. He ended up in the witness protection program. He ended up being a truck driver because he used to call this one guy every once in a while and from some other part of the United States and just shoot the shit with him. Yeah, and he was a horrible drug addict and got in recovery and he kicked drugs and he got a job as a truck driver and ended up going straight in the end. And John Long he testified against Junior. But this Polaroid film deal, this is what's a guy like Junior, and he's a nice guy, and he has all these connections. So what we finally found out, they got the guy in and threatened him and sweated him, and he broke down because he wasn't like a regular criminal. And what he had was a connection with another guy who worked on a dock that had Polaroid film coming through it, and he was stealing it off the dock, so nobody was ever really reporting this Polaroid film as stolen in a normal kind of a police report deal.
Because it wasn't coming out of like a camera store.
And actually, a shoplift's not reported either. I mean, it's there's no serial numbers on razor blades. And if you don't catch somebody stealing it, it's just shrinkage. You don't know whether, somebody counted wrong or whether employees are stealing it or whether, the last 10 people, 8 of them grabbed a pack of razor blades. You don't know how it's going out. And so this guy had this connection. And what's even funnier is he had actually been given this connection from a friend of his who knew Junior and knew this guy. And so this guy
set him up.
Had set him up, and he sold him the connection so then he could continue going and getting the Polaroid film from the guy who was stealing off the dock. And he connected him with Junior and then take it to Junior. And he was making, like $100 a month by selling Junior this Polaroid film, and the other guy was probably making $25 a month. And so it just kind of this, he had all these connections like that all over the city. It was just really interesting stuff. I can hardly wait to get that Freedom of Information Act request to get all the details that I didn't really know about.
Now, when you ask for a Freedom of Information Act like this, don't you have to be really specific about what you're asking for?
Well, yeah, that's the problem with somebody. They'll give you a lot. But if there's too much in there, then they want to charge you a lot of money. You can get a lot for $25. And so what I did, I narrowed it down. I knew the years of that investigation and up until the conviction. And so I narrowed it to those years. So I think I can get everything I want
on that.
Probably
on
no
that
more
era
than maybe $100. I'm not sure. It depends on how much going digging around they have to do.
Yeah. Well, it's 25 just to submit it.
It's 25. Like I did one on the Spiro brothers and they scared me off. It was going to be several hundred dollars to get everything and you don't know what's in it. And so I got the one that I could get for the $25, original $25 investment, had about 300 pages and about 300 pages and about 290 of them were basically worthless. And the other 10 were iffy at best. There was stuff I kind of already knew. They were interesting, but they weren't that great. It's a crapshoot unless you just got, if you're one of these big newspapers or a professional author who is actually making
an investment. Yeah, if you were going to take this material and write a book.
Right. If you're making an investment in it, then it would be worth several hundred dollars or maybe even $1,000 to just get everything. It just depends. I'm hoping for no more than maybe 100 or so I can get everything out of that investigation because it's a fascinating investigation. Mm-hmm. It goes into the black mafia and drugs and hitmen and professional shoplifters and boosting and the mafia and everything and have a cross section of organized crime, both black and the drug crime in Kansas City in the 1980s.
Well, and you don't think necessarily about boosting And that kind of thing is really being what the mob's about.
But it's a huge, it was a huge moneymaker. I'm curious, are there any locations out there today? I don't know if there are. I've kind of lost track. And there's so many.
I would think if they were anywhere.
If you heard of one,
if you're boosting and you're selling stuff like razor blades and you're selling, you know, personal care items, if you will, that like a swap meet where you pay 20, 30 bucks or whatever for come in for the on a weekend and you're like, well, here's my stuff. And then, you know, and you pack up and go home.
Yeah, that's probably what's happening.
As opposed to having a physical storefront, which is probably in some ways a liability.
Yeah.
You know,
But out of the 50s,
there 60s. Was somebody up, I think, up in the old, I want to say in the old Northeast, there's a place called Super Flea.
Yeah.
And a lady there some time back, this was some years ago, I remember hearing about this, had a shop in the Super Flea. And those are more like you rent them out, and I think you keep the space. You don't move in and out.
They're like booths.
Like booths. Yeah. And they came in, and she got raided, I believe. And
oh, really? Okay.
A lot of personal good items that were that probably were stolen.
Shoplifters, yeah. I think there was a lady over in Kansas that was
But it wasn't anybody I knew. It was just reported by somebody who happened to also have a, to me, if you were in conversation, who happened to also have a booth in that Super Flea that they later sold and got out of there.
Yeah. Okay. And you know, maybe I think the mob got out of that business. I don't know.
It would be difficult when you, especially higher dollar items, some personal care items. I mean, they have, you know, they track them by a barcode, other things, you know, they actually have the little IDs, radio IDs.
Yeah.
They can track stuff by now. And with geolocating, they keep track of, you know, the semis as they're traveling. So
yeah.
Having stuff just fall out of the back and not know where that happened is, I would think, a little harder.
Yeah, I think it's, I know, like, a friend of mine, when he retired from the police department in 1997 or 98, his job that he already had lined up was with some trucking outfits just to go, this is early in the camera thing, was just to go camera them all up big time. And one of them in particular was Yellow Freight. And Yellow Freight had more thieves working in that back in the 50s and 60s and 70s at Teamsters. It was just riddled. I don't know what the deal was with the management at Yellow Freight, but I think they were a little bit lax and they would rather pay off mob people rather than fight union trouble or something. And they had a lot of mob guys working there. And so a lot of things fell off the back of their trucks. But, you know, they just don't stand for that anymore. Big corporations own them. And now they've cameraed everything up like
you said. Yeah, it just seems like it's so much easier to track everything than it was back then.
Yeah, it's everything is much more sophisticated today. Like, I mean, you know,
surveillance.
Like we were kidding about you don't shoplift an item, but you go pirate some songs and then make up a bunch of bootleg CDs or make up a bunch of bootleg
DVDs of movies. And you see that, I think, out at some of those kind of swap meets and stuff. But
that and the copyright violation for like Chief shirts and Royal shirts and band shirts and things like that.
When those guys pop up here and there, you'll see them on the side of the street, you know, somewhere. There's one was down on Main Street right there by the subway, $10 Royal shirts.
Right. And then he went to $5 at the end the other day. Yeah, there were $5. I almost stopped and bought one. You know,
it's official enough.
There's
for
$5. Five of them around the city that all look the same, but that was one of these copyright people
that just takes it. You don't think they actually paid for the trademark and the royalty rights to do that? No,
they just set up.
Not when it's $5.
Yeah. So anyhow, I don't know. I think that's all I got for this
this episode
tonight. You got anything more, Aaron?
You know, here's
any questions.
What I've got is, do you have anything that you can tease people with for 2016?
Well, you know, the story of Tiger Carterello, the life and death of Tiger Carterello. You know, he screwed up a mob hit when he was young and then died as a result of a mob hit when he was old. And in between, made a lot of money for the mob and selling stolen record albums. And Junior Bradley, that was a little bit of a tease.
And
tonight.
Ticket sales. And, wasn't it concert tickets?
Concert tickets, yeah. That's another thing that he took money out of the concert ticket thing. That's what got Tiger in trouble for was snagging money out of the concert tickets. Again, it was then you bought them with cash. You don't even buy them with a credit card.
Yeah.
You came in with 10 bucks in cash for two.
And he wasn't wet in the beak, you think?
Oh, yeah. He was. He snagged money out of that and screwed the promoter. And that's what got him in trouble, I believe. You just don't, you know, it's like killing the golden goose. It's, you know, because there was huge money in that. Yeah. It was all cash money.
And then you've also got waiting for that freedom of information, of course, on Junior Bradley.
Junior Bradley and Jerry Stevens and kind of how the mob made money from the shoplifters and how that worked and what those guys were into. We're going to do Bob Berdella.
Bob Berdella at some point.
The serial killer. I've got the sergeant. I just talked to him. I had lunch with him the other day, and he's willing to come in here, and we'll bring him in and talk about that investigation. That'll probably be a two- or three-parter.
Well, one of the things
I might do that Breeden, that serial killer there that I have those notes on, the Independence Avenue serial killer.
Yeah, we were going to, well, and sometime after the first of the year, the guest that we were going to have on tonight.
Right.
We'll hopefully come back on, and we'll talk about
Old Northeast.
The Old Northeast and the Dirty Avenue.
And the Dirty Avenue, yeah.
Of Independence Avenue.
And then there was a serial killer over there. They arrested the guy, and they never could make a case on him. I'm not sure if he was a guy. This was the one where the bodies, they were all street girls, prostitutes, and they were finding them in the Missouri River down about Lexington, and their legs were cut off. The plot to kidnap Muriel Kaufman and hold her in a box for ransom. And that's a really interesting story. And this guy that did it, he's an interesting guy. I've had a Freedom of Information Act out on him for several months now. And I've got back two returns, one from the federal penitentiary's federal prison system and one from the federal probation and parole system. And both of them deny that they have any evidence of this guy. So I'm waiting on the FBI now.
See if they've got any evidence in their files.
Now, there's got to be, because he's a two or three time convicted bank robber. But that's
not the material you want. You want the material about what happened with Muriel Kaufman.
I've got that. I've got everything I need to know about that. I don't have the material about his life of crime before he went into this plot. If I can't get it, or if there's not much there, then because at first I thought this would make a heck of a true crime book, because this guy, here's what he was doing, Aaron. He and his brother are from Connecticut, and they were robbing banks, and they would put a bomb at the local police station. It would be in these middle-sized towns, smaller towns, not Kansas City. Or a big town that has substations all over the place. But
just one main station.
Main station. They put a bomb at the station. They'd go rob the bank when the bomb went off. And they did several of them. And then there was from a dysfunctional family. He ended up killing his mother and stepfather. And then was arrested. His brother, I think, ratted him out on that or something. Anyhow, they caught a bank robbery case. They had been robbing these banks with using these bombs. His brother ends up dying, and he goes to the federal penitentiary. He gets himself put in Springfield, saying he's crazy, and they end up releasing him because he's crazy. And when he gets released from Springfield, he comes to Kansas City, and he engages in this plot to kidnap Muriel Kaufman. And which was quite an intricate plot, and quite he spent several months laying the groundwork on this thing. So those are several stories I've got
working on for next 2016.
Year. Right.
And you'd put up the page to let people know if they wanted to actually have us come out and do this.
Right.
You do it yourself as well. But as the two of us going out or...
we did the live podcast, and Aaron had this idea, and I think it's a good idea. Maybe like a winery would want to draw a bunch of people in to taste their wine and have some kind of entertainment. Well, we could do a live recording of our podcast.
Yeah, a live version of one of the episodes.
The River Key. We could talk about the River Key. That's an always popular story, or the skimming from Las Vegas or some of those.
Those are ones you haven't really even gone into the skimming.
No, I haven't. You know,
I've done Las Vegas.
Actually, I've done the River Key so many times, I haven't done that either. I figure most of the people that are listening may know that story. If you've rented or bought my movie, seen my movie, then you know some of these stories.
Wasn't it like the 30th anniversary of the movie Casino?
It was. I saw that. 30th anniversary.
It's like the right time. We maybe have to put that on the calendar for a topic, if nothing else, to talk about the skimming.
I'm always like, I'm going to give a talk this January to retired UMKC professors. They're paying me to give kind of a post, a program. Graham talk. They have a meeting periodically, and they need speakers. And so they're paying me, and they just – I'll show a little clips from my movie, and I'll talk about the River Key and kind of the – since it's the high end, it's retired UMKC professors, I'll talk about the kind of the sociological impact and on a city of having a grassroots area that then is destroyed because of a mob war and how much that affected Kansas City at the time. And so that's but that, you know, if you know of a winery or know somebody that might want to have a program to draw people in,
I'm trying to think of a bar or a location.
A craft beer bar, or somebody that has a craft beer that want to introduce people to their beer and have some kind of entertainment, we'd certainly be
happy
to talk to them about doing it.
Come out there and do a live version of the program.
There's never ending voracious appetite for mob stuff, I've found out. Everybody likes to hear about
it. And January is mob month in Vegas. Are you going out to Vegas?
You know, I've
not got your ticket.
I tried to work a deal
with the guys from the library,
the mob museum. I went out last year for the Clark County Library and their mob month, their program. They had one program each night, each week. And so I tried to work something out with the mob museum, but by the time I got around to it, they were already booked up because I'm going out in February to take my Underground Railroad museum. They liked me so much at the Clark County Museum, they wanted me to come back and ask me if I had any other programs. I said, well, I got this Underground Railroad thing that I think
is... Which is great for February.
It's great for February, Black History Month and all that. So
if you could get the first... Did you get the first week in February?
I can't remember.
So you could kind of bumper in there at the end of...
Yeah, Mob Month
in Vegas.
I tried to work something out to get out there and maybe the last of January and the first, and then work into the 1st of February, but it just didn't work out. Maybe next year I'll get to the Mob History Museum. I've talked to a lot of people who have been to it, and they say it's quite a place. The first call, a place that I've done a lot of work for, and I give a little money to every now and then, and I like to give them a little plug.
If you've got a family member, a loved one, a friend with an addiction problem, be it alcohol, drugs, gambling,
sex, drugs, or rock and roll, as we say,
then make your first call to First Call. Find them online at firstcallkc.org.
Or 816-361-5900.
And also, you didn't forget to mention that if you enjoy this podcast, you can buy Gangland Wire, the documentary.
Great Christmas present.
Online, it's available. And you could also buy merchandise.
Including my T-shirt.
He's got a T-shirt for sale. And download the podcast and give us a review online.
Right.
Let us know what you think.
The Kansas City Mob Tour app. Just go to your app store and type in Kansas City Mob Tour, and you'll find my mob app. And you can take a tour of Kansas City mob sites. Personally guided by me, only I won't be there.
Have you ever added any of the video or audio clips in from some of the episodes?
I've got some of the podcast.
Because the podcast, frequently we're talking about stuff like, Tiger Cartarello's, record store. Where's that located? Is that in there?
That's in there. Yes, that's in there. Pictures of what the record store used to look like and things like that. So it's all there. Or if you donate $25 or more, I will send you a copy of the DVD or the Gangland Wire T-shirt, whichever you want.
Or you can just make a donation.
Or just make a donation of $1 or $5. We'll take anything because those Freedom of Information Acts aren't cheap. Plus, we got the studio.
And you don't know how much they're going to be till they come back with all the paperwork.
You don't know. They do give you an option. They'll say, here's how much there is. And here's what we can do. And so you can tailor it, get it down to some kind of a budget. It's just so hard because you're paying for so much stuff that you don't really care.
Yeah.
Booking slips. And if I was really doing a real study and I
If you're doing a book, I think you could add that kind of stuff.
But I just want the stories.
Yeah.
And they won't go through and just pull out the reports with the stories in them. I wish they would. Okay.
All right. Well, remember to follow Gangland Wire. They're on Instagram at instagram.com/GanglandWire. And of course, GanglandWire.com, Gary Jenkins. If you need an attorney, Gary Jenkins, he's an attorney.
Right. And I'm mainly doing traffic tickets right now.
So if you need somebody that knows the court system here in Kansas City.
Yeah,
I may even know the officers or the judge.
Not really.
But better than all of that, knows his way around the law.
Exactly.
Then contact Gary Jenkins. Follow him on Twitter at twitter.com/Jenks Law.
All right. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Gary.